Everybody, I'm so happy you all came. I've been living with Fra Angelico for a while in anticipation of this evening, and I must say it's been a pleasure. I thought we would start out singing a song that we all know, but it captures the feeling of Fra Angelico. You all know you can fill my heart with music. So close your eyes. You fill my heart with music. I dance through life with thee. I sing your song and sorrow's gone. In joy I live ever free. You fill my heart with music. I dance through life with thee. I sing. Italian. Il mio cuore tuo, Signore sempre tuo, cantando a te, amando te, nella gioia del ciel vivrò. Il mio cuore tuo, Signore sempre tuo, cantando a te. Nice job. There were so many songs I could have chosen, but I chose that one because our subject tonight, Fra Angelico, comes from Italy, and he comes from a little town that I'm going to talk about tonight. But I'm first going to set the stage in terms of the time period. He was right smack dab in the middle of Kali Yuga. His dates are 1387 to 1455, and it was truly a dark age. But he was not dark. And he shared that stage, he was a little later, with St. Francis and St. Dominic and a whole bunch of people. Tuscany grows more than sunflowers. It grows saints. And I was counting in my mind, how many Tuscan saints do I know? And I think, you know, we have St. Francis and St. Dominic. And Fra Angelico, actually, I have to tell you this, he was never canonized. So institutionally, he's not a saint. But perhaps tonight we'll canonize him. I don't know. And then there was Joseph of Cupertino and St. Catherine of Siena. And who else from Tuscany? St. Benedict, that's right. So you have actually the Dominicans, the Franciscans, and the Benedictines, for those of you who are Catholic out there. And by the end of our evening, you'll probably all be more Catholic than you were. So when I was asked by Ramamurti if I would do this class, I really hesitated. And I hesitated for two reasons. One is, you know, the usual, oh, I'm so busy. And then the other one was, how would I ever choose? You know, what saint could I really do justice to? So I actually said yes, and then I thought about it, didn't I, Ramamurti, for a couple of days. And what kept coming to my mind was Fra Angelico, who wasn't even an official saint. But I had a personal experience with Fra Angelico. I went to college at a place way down the road in San Rafael called Dominican University. And when you go to college at a Dominican institution, you find out about Fra Angelico. We went to eat in a place, it was called Cala Ruega. That is the birthplace of St. Dominic. We did all of our music lessons in Angelica Hall for Fra Angelico. We had Guzman, which was also part of St. Dominic. I mean, it goes on and on and on, so it just gets in your blood. But the other part of it was that I knew Fra Angelico from the time I was just a little girl. And I think many of you did too, if you really think about it, because he shows up on Christmas cards. Do you remember? Especially that flight into Egypt card with Mary on the donkey holding the baby and Joseph being so paternal and protective. And then, after I graduated from Dominican University, my father gave me a year of grace. That's what I called it. And I didn't have to do anything except go get experience. That's how he labeled it. They have a term for it now. It's called that gap year. I like year of grace better. And I chose to go to Italy, and I chose to go to Florence. So I spent a lot of time just winding my way and actually getting lost because it's very circular. And I come from San Francisco, and that's not circular. It's, you know, diet. And I would go of a morning and say to myself, who am I going to meet today? And I didn't mean real people walking around people. I meant all of those characters, historical characters who have imbued that city with their energy. Some of my most special moments were spent at San Marco, which is one of the monasteries where Fra Angelico, well, we'll talk about it later, but he left his mark. But I had a very special experience in Fiesole. So you go to Florence, and Florence is on the flat, and in Firenze, they call it, the light is very, very special. There's something so clear and so radiant about the light in Florence. So you're in Florence, and there's the River Arno. And then, in my case, I would take a bus many times and go up to Fiesole, which is a hill city. It's just a town. And there are all kinds of terraces and beautiful trees and green grass. And as we would round a corner, you would see it on the right-hand side, and that was San Domenico, which was the monastery where Fra Angelico spent a great deal of time. And I had in Fiesole many friends. They were all very spiritual friends. I ran into a bunch of Irish blue nuns. They were, believe it or not, from Germany. I never figured that one out. But we would sit and we would talk, and it was so easy to have as our subject those things that were spiritual. And then my own personal experience of Fra Angelico came to, I think, a kind of culmination about a year and a half ago when Shanti organized a pilgrimage to Italy. There were about 25 of us, maybe, all of us Kriyabans, meditators, who went, and we kind of followed in the footsteps of St. Francis. It was a serious in the sense that we weren't really going to sightsee the usual kinds of spots. We were going to those powerhouse spiritual spots that contained vibration of the great saints, the great ones. And that's what we did. But then, of course, reality takes over, and you know you're going to come back. And you know that you should bring something for somebody, or many. So we were on our way one day to Cortona. And I had never been to Cortona. All the time I've spent to Italy, I just never made it. I didn't have any preconception of that little hilltop town. And we were specifically going to go so that there was time built in after we saw some great saints and some great sightseeing places. We were specifically going to go shopping. The key was that because it was off the beaten track, so to speak, relative to Florence itself, you could get good bargains. Well, we got the bargain of our life. We're walking around, and I forget who made the suggestion, but they said, oh, you know, there's a little museum down the way. You just go down this street and over there, and there it is, and it's supposed to have some good things. And I thought, well, you never know. So off we went. Not everybody. Shanti was there. And we walk in and we're looking around. It's got some Etruscan things. It goes way back. And we walk into what I would consider the great room. And on the far wall was this beautiful, beautiful painting. And I looked at it and I thought, could it be? Really? Here in Cortona? And it was one of Fra Angelico's great masterpieces. And you're going to see that tonight. And I'll tell you that now as a mature adult coming into contact with the artistry of this great soul, it was a spiritual experience. It was not a tourist experience. It was not sightseeing. Heidi, you were there. Were you in? Oh, you didn't? Oh. Oh. Yeah. And I can remember, when I show it to you, you'll know what I'm speaking about. I can remember standing in front of it and literally not being able to move away easily. And other people were saying, oh, you should see here, there are other rooms. And so eventually I did. I moved into the next room. There were beautiful things there too, but I always came back. It was like he was reeling me in like a fish. And I literally felt the power. And here we are. He's back in 1387 to 1455. And here we are. It was 2015. That's a lot of souls to impact with your life's work. Oh, would that we all were so powerful. So here we go. And hopefully, I'm going to give credit to Ram Dass who helped me put this on. But I'm going to start with a little background. Ram Dass, do I just press the go thing? Pardon me? Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to start a little bit with St. Dominic because St. Dominic was the inspiration for Fra Angelico. This is a detail. It shows St. Dominic. He's in an attitude of contemplation. And Fra Angelico's whole life was based on contemplation. He was a monastic of the First Order. It really leads into the next one, which is, that's it. That's the Annunciation. That's the Cortona piece. And I wish that it were as large as the real one is, because it covered a great part of the wall. And when you confronted it, you can see that the colors and the light assault your senses. And if you look at it very closely, you'll see that it's set within a classical setting, the arches. And it has some wonderful touches. Those are little stars on the top ceiling that you can glimpse through the archways. And of course, there are the angel wings. One thing about Fra Angelico was he loved angels. They show up in all of his paintings. And he is so, he's mystical, but he's also capricious. There's this joy that comes through in his use of color. And I think this shows it. But this shows something much more than that. We will come back to this painting. But what it shows is his ability to put on canvas an inner state, his own inner state. He often painted in an exalted state. He never picked up a paintbrush without saying a prayer. He never changed a line. He never redid anything. Because as Vasari says, and Vasari was the historian of the time, and he made it his business to put on record what the great souls in art and music and sculpture were doing and what lives they were leading. And what he says is that when Angelico would paint something in the life of Christ that was sad, like the crucifixion, that he would weep tears of compatibility. It was his way of expressing what was in his soul. And so he's not reacting to the painting like I am. He's simply expressing the state of grace that he finds himself in. Now, the virgin is on the right, and she has her hands across her chest in a spirit of great devotion. She was caught praying, and you can see, if you look closely, the little prayer book on her knee. And she's looking at the angel, leaning forward in an attitude of receptivity, and the angel is telling her something. And what the angel is saying is, the angel is saying, you will become the mother of Jesus. And she's saying, how can that be? I have not known a man. And the angel says, with God, all things are possible. And in this moment, Mary says, behold the handmaiden of the Lord. The ultimate in receptivity, to acknowledge that you will do what is being asked of you, even if you don't understand it, because it comes from God. And to do that, we have to be in tune. Mary was so in tune with everything. She never made a false step. Her son did rebuke her every now and then. But then she showed her spunk at the marriage feast of Cana when she said, you know, fill the jars with wine. And he said, I'm not ready to go on the road, mother. And she said, do what I say. And then that was his first miracle. So she had a lot of spunk, but she had attunement and receptivity. One of the things that comes out of this particular rendition of the Annunciation, and there are many Annunciations, here's another one, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But one of the things that comes out is not only the receptivity of Mary, but the conviction of the angel that with God, all things are possible. And for Angelico, that was something he lived his life by. And as we go through his life, you'll see that much is being asked of him. And always the answer is yes. So when I came back from Italy, I was inspired to read the life of Fra Angelico again. And I don't have a full-scale biography of him. I'm sure there are many out there. But I do recommend this book. It's called Men Who Have Walked with God, and it's by Sheldon Cheney. It's an old book. Mine's falling apart, and the Fra Angelico one would fall out if I turned it this way and didn't hold it tightly. But Sheldon Cheney just takes the mystics from Lao Tzu all the way to William Blake, and he puts them in their historical perspective, which is very interesting. Because, you know, Swami always taught that the great masters come for the age. They have that continuity of message, and it's all about God, and it's all about attunement. It's all about grace and love and faith. But it's sculpted for the moment. And so when you read a book like this, it's very interesting to see what was the moment in which a particular soul came into the world to grace us with his presence. So we're going to start with the beginning. Fra Angelico, as you know, was born in Tuscany. And he was not born in Firenze, Florence. He was born in a little valley called Mugello. It's up near Firenze, near Fiesole. And it's just, it's farmland. There's not much choice there. You either become a farmer or, and this is interesting, you become an artisan. So isn't that interesting? Both of which are extremely creative. So he and his younger brother, 2 years, Benedetto, decided to go the artisan route, and they went to a little school there, and they learned the art of illustration and illumination. You know, on our trip, we went to Siena. Now, I've seen books, I've seen replicas of illumination, but when you see the real thing, in that Duomo in Siena, they had a whole library of illuminated manuscripts And truly, I could have spent a week there without budging. So, okay, next slide. So this is an example of the Annunciation that was an illustration in a missal done by Fra Angelico. Of course, he wasn't known as Fra Angelico then. His name, given name, was Guido. And then, ultimately, he entered the monastery in Fiesole, and he took the name of Giovanni. That's the Italian for John. And he did it, well, I'll tell you that in a minute. So in this particular illustration, the Virgin, who is at the base of the letter R, is looking up at the angel. And again, her hands are crossed and she has the little missal on her lap. And in the round part of the R at the top is God the Father. And he's doling out the Holy Spirit on the end of a thread. Isn't that wonderful? It's just so capricious. So she's filled with the Holy Spirit. That moment of the Annunciation was filled with the Holy Spirit. And that's what Fra Angelico wanted to communicate. And of course, the angel is wonderful, and the whole thing is perfectly balanced. But it was probably about this tiny. This is all blown up. And then we have another one. This is an illumination, not just a little illustration in a missal. But this was in a manuscript. It looks like it's a musical manuscript. And the subject matter is the glorification of Saint Dominic. Fra Angelico never forgot that he was a Dominican. And those Dominicans loved their founder. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. But here he was, and he creates this beautiful piece. Dominic is surrounded by angels at the top. And then you see the medallions, the four medallions below that. And at the very bottom, on the left-hand side, there's one last circle. Do you know who's in that circle? That's Dominic on the right and St. Francis on the left. And throughout the life of the Dominican order was a very special relationship between the Dominicans and the Franciscans. And it goes back, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So later on, after he did this small work, Fra Angelico was known as having tremendous talent. And we can see that. So he graduated and he did larger panels and he did frescoes and large paintings such as the first Annunciation that I showed you. This is another example of his work. It's not an Annunciation, but it's the Madonna and the Child surrounded by angels. And this was a big work. And you can see, again, there's the coloration and there's a kind of formality to this painting, which was of the time. You'll notice that there's the pedestal on which Our Lady is sitting, and then above her is a tabernacle, and it's hexagonal, and it's very formal. And that was something that they did in those days. But what's different is, if you look at her face, it's a different face than the Annunciation. She's had the baby. And there, that particular picture, even though there's a formality to it, you can see in her face a serenity and acceptance. And the baby's so relaxed, and he's relating to the angels, and it's just absolutely glorious. This, of course, was what Fra Angelico was feeling about all of the spirituality that he was reading. Because every morning the monks would get up and they would say the office. And they would sing it. And the office is simply a rendition of the Psalms, giving glory to God. And then they would go through the New Testament. And they read the Gospels. And they read the Epistles. So this was their, so to speak, meat and drink. And all of this filtered through him, not through his head, through his heart. Onto his brushes, onto the canvases or the frescoes or whatever it was. Now, there's one more I'm going to show you. All is not light in the Bible. And Fra Angelico, sometimes people try to make him cute and kind of dear in a cloying way. He was not that. He was a realist. And he also knew that there were the forces of darkness in the world. And I'll tell you more about that. But this particular piece is called The Last Judgment. And at the apex of it, you see Jesus. And on the right and the left, and those two arcs at the top, you see all the saints and holy people, the apostles. Then on the left panel below, you see this picture, and I think this will bring it home to you a little bit more. I can show it to you. This is the detail of the angels greeting all of the people and bringing them to paradise. And you can see, I have this hanging in my bedroom because I want to remind myself about what Padre Pio said. Padre Pio said that when we die, our guardian angel is going to come and get us. And I believe that. And I hope he brings his friends. So that's the light side. But then on the right, you have the dark side. Those are the souls which, according to the conventional wisdom of the Bible, were consigned to hell and is very dark. There's a story later on. Maybe I should tell it now. Almost close to his death, he became famous and he was asked to go to the little town of Orvieto to do a rendition of the Last Judgment. So he goes. And he tries. He just can't do it. He just had to leave. And he never did do it. They were going to commission him and pay him, you know, not that he took the money personally. But he couldn't do it because his soul was so light. And you know, Master always said, if you want to dispel the darkness, turn on the light. And this, of course, is what Fra Angelico was doing his life long. He didn't have those words, but he definitely had the concept. And then I love this. In the middle, do you see that walkway with the little squares on it? Those are the openings of graves to give us the idea that the souls at the judgment day come out of the grave and then they get assigned. You know, it's not English 1A and History 1B. It's heaven or hell. And so One of the descriptives that Sheldon Cheney makes, he's the author of the book, about Fra Angelico, is that he calls him the tool of God. Now, in our lexicon, we would say instrument. But that was so appropriate for his age. His consciousness was reflected in his subject matter and in the treatment of his subject matter. It wasn't like he was trying. He was just channeling. And as a result, it's not that we just get the devotional nature of him in these works, but it's a revelation, I think, of his experience of God's presence in his life. And that was his sole goal. He wanted to live a life where God was at the center. And that's what you did in those days. You entered a monastery. They didn't have spiritual communities like ours. You entered a monastery, you left everything behind. You took a vow of poverty, obedience, and chastity. And you did what everybody told you to do. But he did it with such joy. And of course, his karma was that his talent, his natural talent, was recognized. And he got to express his spirituality and the devotion and his experience of God in his paintings. So here he is. That's Fra Angelico by Carlo Colci. And it's a portrait. It's in the Accademia in Florence. And you can see it. So as postulants, do you know what a postulant is? In the monastic system, if you want to enter the convent, you've seen Sound of Music, you know, Maria, in that she goes into the convent and she gets to wear that little black outfit with the apron. She was a postulant. And then if you last, then you get the habit and you take vows and you dedicate your life, and it's a very serious thing. So he went as a postulant with his brother Benedetto to the Dominican monastery in Fiesole. And it was up on a hillside. It's the little church that I told you about, and here it is. I wish I could take you inside, but I couldn't figure that part out. Ram Dass didn't have an opportunity for that one. So in this particular monastery, he was with other Dominicans who were of the same mind. Now, this is really key, because for us here who have dedicated our lives to trying to know God as deeply as we possibly can, that kind of shared goal is so powerful, and must be cherished, must never be squandered. And what Fra Angelico did was just that. He cherished every moment. He made the best of it. He did everything that was asked of him from an early age. Some people are just born to it. So little by little, as he became known, he painted the walls and the public places, like the refectory where everybody gathered to eat, or the chapel, or the chapter room where they went to confess their sins. Do you know about chapter rooms? Probably not. A chapter room is a very important part of the cloister. I don't know how often they used to do it, but certainly it was at least once a week where all of the community would gather. And they would publicly confess their failings. And then the prior, in the event of women, the prioress, the head person, would bless them. And it was a kind of public confession. But really, the spirit of it was, we're a community, we're brothers, we're sisters, and whatever we do that might take away from that family, our spiritual family, we need to say it out loud and then get rid of it and be forgiven. I don't think they do that anymore. This was definitely medieval. And it has lasted up into maybe the last time I'm aware of it ever happening was like the 1970s, probably. And now I don't think they do it. But there was something about that. At any rate, he painted all, it was as if he came in here and you looked around and all you saw were Fra Angelico's. It's unusual. Usually we go to a museum and we only see, well, a little Michelangelo, maybe a little Tintoretto, maybe Fra Angelico. You see little by little, but he, it was all Fra Angelico. So he needed helpers. And he had apprentices. It's like a sous chef. You know, you go in there and they mix the paints and that kind of thing. And he would talk to them. He would teach them. And these are a few of the things that he taught. And I think that they relate to us in our lives. He said to his fellow workers that an artist should cultivate quiet seclusion. That if he made it his business to deal with the stories of Christ, he should then see to it that he lived in Christ. He lived his own life this way and believed that he was the tool of God. And he never retouched a picture, and I've already said that. And he worked with a mystic's strange state of combined humility and confidence. Think about that. Humility and confidence. We don't ordinarily put those two words together. But of course we should. Because if our humility before God is such that we accept and know things as they truly are, then we can move ahead. Think about that. And that the artist should work in a state of devotion and at times rapture. So whatever we do, whatever our art is, that's what we have to do when we're doing it. I mean, I remember one time, I loved to play tennis, and I had this one day where I could do no wrong. I literally was all over the court. My poor partner, she was just a mess. And so I was playing her game and my game, and I was just, and it was like an ecstatic, in a way, I'm not saying this is spiritual, but in a way, it was an ecstatic experience of being the best I could be without giving it any thought, without feeling any pride whatsoever. Just because it was in front of me, I did it. It only happened once. And when I was finished, it was a hot day, I had blisters all over, huge blisters all over my feet. I never felt it the whole time. Because I was not attached to my body, and I wasn't even attached to my ego that much. You know, I was just, it was in front of me, I was channeling something. And I think that if we could take that kind of energy, the kind of energy Fra Angelico is talking about, that so much would be possible for us. So much advancement on the spiritual path. And that's what we want. So we have a mission, every single one of us. We may not be Fra Angelico, but we definitely have a mission. The other thing that I think is in his work that is worthy of great notice is there's a tenderness in how he renders his subjects. And, you know, well, let me see. Did I miss a slide? Well, let's go back to this one. Let's go to St. Dominic. If you look at St. Dominic, he was a major spiritual figure. But Fra Angelico didn't render him that way. He rendered him in this just moment of quiet thought, concentration. And when you look at him, there isn't a line. He's just totally immersed. And you know it's spiritual because he's reading a holy book. And his whole attitude is one of humility. It's not, I know what I'm talking about and I'm going to tell you. It's just, he's present in the moment. So St. Dominic, I need to tell you a little bit about him because he was such an inspiration for all of Fra Angelico's life. He was born, as I said, in Calaruega in Spain in 1170. So he came a lot earlier than Fra Angelico. He was of the nobility. And he was related to the ruling family. And of course, class and status meant a great deal. But his mother was a holy woman. And the night before he was born, she had a dream. And in the dream, it was told to her that this boy was special and he would be God's. So she was right. The dream was right. Dominic grew up and he made the choice. He could have, you know, been part of the ruling family if he wanted to. He could have been in the military. He could have done anything that the nobility does. Instead, he joined the Benedictine order. Benedict had founded his own order way back, I think it's the 11th century, but I might be wrong on that. But it was one of the early orders where it was work and pray and meditate. There was a third one, good works probably. That was the sign of that order. Anyway, Dominic was really intelligent and refined. And he spent his life fighting what at the time was a major threat to the Catholic Church. And that was the Albigensian heresy. So the Albigensians believed that everything related to the body was evil. Everything. And all material things were evil. So you try living your life like that. It's not healthy, and it's not true. But people believed it. And in those days, there was a great deal of superstition, and you always had the specter of hell. You know, if you go back to that Last Judgment Day picture, in those days, that was the construct in the Christian countries. So he was also associated, St. Dominic, with the Inquisition, but only in the beginning, before it got terrible. Legend has it that he received the rosary from Our Lady, that he had an apparition. And do you all know what a rosary is? This is my rosary, one of them. A rosary is like our malas. I don't have my mala with me, but you count the beads and you say the Hail Mary on the first 10 beads. Then when you get to the 11th bead, you say, and Our Father. And you repeat that 5 times. So it's like doing our Kriya or our meditation. While you're doing that, you're supposed to be in a state of recollection. Now that is a code word. That's a code word for meditation. The idea is that you would, after the repetition so many times, always thinking, and that was more mental than what we're used to, but always thinking of one of the great mysteries. There were the joyful mysteries, there were the sorrowful mysteries, and there were the glorious mysteries. And these were mysteries, each mystery was a decade of the rosary, 10. Each of these mysteries acknowledged a time in God's life. Like, for example, the joyful mysteries, the Annunciation of Our Lady, the visitation of Mary to Elizabeth when John the Baptist was still in utero, the Nativity, Christmas, the presentation of our Lord at the temple, which, well, I'll tell you about that in a minute, and then finding Jesus in the temple when he was 12 years old and he got lost in Jerusalem. Do you all know those stories? You need to, if you don't, you need to go read the Bible and the New Testament. Catch up. So you would do that, and as you're saying the rosary, I know this because my mother used to insist that we would say the rosary after dinner every single night before we did homework. And, you know, we begrudged it. I hate to say it, but we did. But we did it. And it became a practice in my growing up that I think was a preparation for me for meditation. And I have to say that when you do that, 5 mysteries, so that's 50 times with 5 Our Fathers, and then there are 5 little beads later on with other prayers you don't need to know about. But you do that, and then your mind stills, and you're ready for something else. So he receives the rosary in this apparition. Now, I know I said it was legend, but interestingly enough, after he purportedly received this in a vision, there was a huge, surge of people who were devoted to the rosary, and that started it, and it continues on to this day in the Catholic Church. So, I don't know, I found out something when I was doing this because I couldn't remember all the mysteries of the rosary, so I looked it up. Google is a wonderful thing. And I discovered that Pope John Paul II had added 5 more mysteries. And he calls them, this is what interested me, he calls them the mysteries of light. Isn't that wonderful? So we have joyful, sorrowful, glorious, and light. And if you want to know what they are, you have to Google it. So Dominic traveled all over the world and he was preaching, but he especially came to Italy. And he was pretty poor. You know, he had a staff, he had a bundle, he was probably barefoot. He drew great crowds, he was a magnetic speaker, and he preached the value of a Christian life. He preached the value of prayer and of study. So he wanted to found, to establish an order like St. Francis did, where his followers and he could gather together and become an order. The Dominicans, after Dominic. So he goes to Italy to see the Pope. And he has a dream. You know, his family had a lot of dreams. And in his dream, he dreams that he meets this person called Francis. The next morning, he gets up and he goes to a church. Now, he's waiting for his audience with the Pope. Meanwhile, St. Francis, now they did not have email, so they did not know what each other was doing. So the next morning, St. Francis shows up at the same church because he also is in Rome waiting for his audience with the Pope to ask if he can have an order. And there's this wonderful meeting of the two, and that's why in some of the pictures that we're going to see, you're always going to see Dominicans and Franciscans. Yeah. Now, at that time, Dominic said to Francis, "Why don't we join ranks? Why don't we establish one order, not two?" And Francis thought about that, and he said no. And who knows why he said no? I have my theories, but I don't know if they're worth anything. But I do know what happened, though, was that as a result of that meeting, they exchanged influences. And this is what that looked like. Dominic took from Francis that sense of poverty that he wanted to give to his people, that they could not live a life of ease, that they had to pare it down to the simplicity of what the Franciscans were doing. And then, when Francis died, do you know the story? How his order was just in tumult. And there were forces that, you know, wanted to have more. They wanted sandals on their feet. They whatever it was that they wanted. And Francis had always been so unassuming and so simple. So in the aftermath of that, ultimately the Franciscans ended up adopting the Constitution of the Dominicans. And from there goes a tradition that to this day is honored. Whenever it's the feast of St. Dominic, the Franciscans go and celebrate. And whenever it's the feast day of Francis, the Dominicans go and celebrate. So I'm sure they figured that deal out in heaven. So, now, historically, it was a time of great unrest. We know it's Kali Yuga, so things couldn't have been very good. But it was especially a time of disharmony and upheaval in the church. If you read Chaucer, who came a little bit before Fra Angelico, he denotes it in the Canterbury Tales. He has these characters who are churchmen, and some of them are very holy, and some of them are not. Not nice at all, and even to the point of debauchery. So that the fact that you might stop by a monastery in this time and expect to experience, have a spiritual experience, was not guaranteed whatsoever. St. Catherine of Siena, just maybe 50 years before, had instituted a revival of the original spirit of the monasteries. You know, the purification of the people who chose the monastic life with St. Catherine was realized. But that was Siena. And in Florence, you had something else happening. It was a humanistic city. It gave birth to the Renaissance. It was the hometown of Michelangelo. And, you know, there was this whole idea of the human body and all things material and all things intellectual of the mind. And somewhere in the course of that, spirit got lost. So that you had a split. Politically, Italy was also divided. This is where Fra Angelico, this simple, pure, beautiful soul, was living. And I remember when I read Dante, the stories of the Guelphs, the Ghibellines, you know, in these walled cities, and they'd go out and they'd kill each other like crazy, and then they'd retreat back into their cities, and it was terrible. There was intrigue and corruption and hysteria and treason and pestilence. The plague came. So the Catholic Church, which had ruled for a long time, had fallen, and the Pope had been a prisoner in Avignon. Now, how this happened is convoluted. I'm not going to go into it. Enough to say that at some point in time, we know he is in the Vatican right now, Vatican City in Italy. But in those days, he had moved to France and come under the influence of the French king. And this caused a problem, a big problem. There were a whole succession of popes who did this. It took away his authority. It diluted the spirituality, and it contributed to the degeneration of the church. It was a time when science was on the ascendancy, when intellect was on the ascendancy, skepticism, atheism, individualism, and so faith and spirituality were muted, and not as you couldn't brush up against them as much as you could beforehand. And as I think about this, I realize I think we're in the same kind of a moment right now. That the forces of darkness are there, and we see them in our own country, but we certainly see them around the world. And the forces of light have been somewhat muted and need to experience an ascendancy. And in order to do that, there needs to be a light source. People gathered together in those days, monasteries, in our day, spiritual communities, who can join their energies and their visions and their spirituality to just blast light out into the world. And ultimately, the light will prevail. So where was the source of light in those days? Well, Fiesole. So outside of Florence, which was where all, you know, the humanists and the scientists, the skeptics, and the monasteries that were corrupt, you just go up the hill a little ways, and this is always the way. You've got the darkness, but you've got the light. You go up the hill a little way, and on the right is San Domenico. San Domenico was founded by this very holy man. His name was Johannes Domenici. He was a reformer. He had turned against the trends in the church and decided that he was going to found a monastery that was based on the qualities that were originally defined as being the qualities of a spiritual life. And so, self-discipline, obedience to the vows, and interestingly enough, mystical communion. Yeah, mystical communion, not holy communion. Not what you go up and you get in the form of a wafer or in the sip of wine, but mystical communion with the Lord. And he was in connection with Catherine of Siena, who was a giant spiritual figure. Also, Raimondo of Capua, whom I don't know. And so he took his followers back to the ideals of St. Dominic, and he practiced poverty, and he practiced evangelical preaching, and he practiced obedience. So the cloister up there on the hill was like harmonious, a beacon of light in this otherwise dark world. And Angelico was an artist of the spirit. He was genuine, I'm quoting here, gracious, inspiring, fostered a general revival of spiritual devotion and a wide reformation of the monastic orders. Known as Fra Giovanni of Fiesole, he came to be known as Fra Angelico because he was the angel-like brother. Isn't that beautiful? I would love that name. Now his art. He was... Gotta go. He was heir to what we call the Byzantine tradition of art that preceded his period. And on the right, I'm sorry, on the left, you see an example of it, the Duccio Madonna. And I don't know if you've had your art history classes, but I remember there's a beauty to it, of this art. But it's more two-dimensional, a little more angular, less realistic. Certainly when you get to Michelangelo, you can really see the difference. But notice on the right, this is by Fra Angelico, Virgin and Child Enthroned. And you see the softness and the radiance. The baby is more realistic. There's that, there's a feeling there. There are feelings in both of them. But art is evolving and enriched. Let's see. So his art is a meditation of his religion. That's how I would call it. He didn't go in there and say, okay, I'm going to divide this canvas into four parts, and here's going to be the center part. He was totally intuitive. Now, at the same time, other things were happening. There was kind of a classical a classical approach to architecture that was coming back. And you can see, well, let's see, where am I? See if I can, okay, back to this one. You can see the classical arches and the columns, and you see how it's balanced. There are the three portals, two portals, but there's another one. And just the angel's wings, everything. It's so classical, and yet, this is his genius. It flows and it glows. There's just something, the feeling of this particular piece from Cortona comes through in a way that's mystical. And it's because he is an artist whose spirituality is what's being channeled, not his expertise. There are very few painters who have been so independent in their ability to put themselves on a canvas and single-minded. He didn't deviate. It was always the stories from the Bible and the lives of the saints. That was it. That was his reading material. So now I'm going to show you. This is a detail from the previous painting. And I don't know, did you see it up there on the top left? All right. So this is the detail. And I just want you to know, he wasn't living in La La Land. He really did understand light and dark, but he proportionately divvied out the light, I mean the dark, so that it was overshadowed by the light. So this is the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. And it represents the potential for darkness, but he puts it in its place. And that's why he couldn't do that Last Judgment scene. You've probably, many of you, seen the Last Judgment by Michelangelo in the Vatican. It's a whole wall. And he even put himself in there. But not Fra Angelico. So I just thought that was interesting. So there's also, let's see, what's coming up? I have to wait. You're just going to have to listen to me for a few minutes. There, he's a monk, right? But in his art, there are all these women. The angels who don't have sex, they don't have a sex, they're very feminine. And he gives a special treatment to women. But it's the kind of treatment, I think, that comes from a truly authentic, sincere monk. Or we could substitute that, spiritual seeker. There's a tenderness in his treatment of women. Let's go back to this one. This is the Adoration of the Magi. I'm probably getting ahead of myself. I've never done a slideshow before. This is kind of fun. But the tenderness comes out in Mary's face on the extreme right. And all of his women, let's see, let's go back to what was in this particular picture. Look at Mary's face. Look at the angel's face. Now, the angel's supposed to be, you know, neither male nor female. But Mary, just so reverent, the way he rendered it. She's fragile. She's lovely. She's girlish. But she's also, you have a sense of her chasteness in this one moment when she's going to find out that she's going to have a baby, and she's not married. You knew that. Yeah. So, later on, when he starts doing paintings of sadder scenes, the Passion of Jesus, we'll see some of those paintings, and the Madonna is there, she's sad, but she's still, there's still the same treatment of women, this honoring of the feminine principle. And I think back to Master. One time he was answering a person, and he said, I just don't know how to relate to God. It just seems so hard. I mean, he's impersonal. There are all of these abstractions around the notion of God. What do I do? And Master said, relate to Divine Mother. She's not impersonal. She will go to the nth degree to reach out to you and support you and love you and hold you. And he said, that's what I do. I loved it. And then one time Swami Kriyananda was talking about Ananda Moy Ma in the same way. He was saying, for me, she is Divine Mother. And he made an interesting statement. He said that it was because of his relationship with Ananda Moy Ma, this great Indian saint, that he being so green on the path, after all, he was only with Master 3 years before Master passed. But it was only because of his relationship with her that he was able to reap the benefit of 3 short years with Master. As if Divine Mother, in the aspect of Ananda Moy Ma, was just channeling this her consciousness, and he, being so receptive, was receiving it. So in 3 years, you know, Jesus and his disciples were together for 3 years. No more, no less. See what can happen in 3 years? So Mary is, I think, Fra Angelico's Divine Mother. And I think that that's how he relates to all women, that they are Divine Mother, channeling the feminine aspect. And what is the feminine aspect? Well, it's love. It's accessibility. When your child asks you for something, it's rare that you would say no. When your child is in trouble, you just bring them into your arms and onto your lap. And you hold them and you love them and you rock them. And if you possibly can, you give them what they want. If you can, if it's not bad for them. So there is this reverence, there is this kind of silent moment in this, and you see this in a lot of his paintings. Just that overlay of peacefulness and silence and reverence. So let's go back to Cortona for a minute. That's the place where we saw this. But in terms of the history of Fra Angelico, lo and behold, I asked myself the question, how did it get here? You know, he was in Florence. Cortona is a ways away, and they didn't have planes in those days. So when you enter a monastery, you have a period of training and also trial. You're trying out. And at any moment, they could say, sorry, you didn't make the cut. That's called postulancy. So for the postulancy, the monks at Fiesole had to go to Cortona. And that's not unusual. They would go to the novitiate in Cortona, and that's where Angelico went and Benedetto for their first year. And so he didn't stop painting. Now, I don't think that this particular painting was done in that period, because he revisited later on, and I will get to that. But in Cortona, there was a follower of the founder of the Fiesole convent with the same values, you know, pushing out against the darkness, keeping that inner spine of steel, of devotion, of determination, all of those things. So there he was. And then also in Cortona, you had the crosshairs of Dominic and Francis coming together yet again. I didn't know this. I might have known this, but I forgot that St. Francis had gone to Cortona, and there's a lake there called Lake Trasimeno. And St. Francis had spent time in seclusion on the island in the middle of the lake. So his vibration, he walked all over the city, his vibration was there. And there was Fra Angelico. Now, in about 1409, a year after Fra Giovanni was professed, all right, he received the robes, he had returned to Fiesole because his novitiate was over. And there was another schism in Rome. And a schism, of course, meant trouble, because it always became political. And Florence was like California in Italy. You know, it's always at the cutting edge. People were always pushing the boundaries in Florence. And if there was going to be a schism, there was going to be trouble. And so there was. There were two popes in France. One was saying, I'm the real pope. The other was saying, no, I'm the real pope. Who knew who was whom? And the people in Florence began to take sides. Well, this was not a good situation for the quiet, devout, sincere monks in Fiesole. The last thing in the whole world they wanted to do was to be political. So they were disrupted, the monasteries were in turmoil, and Florence, as a town, this is kind of like Trump versus Clinton, they voted for the pope who wasn't the real pope. And as a result, the monks knew that they couldn't stay in their beautiful little convent in Fiesole. So they left, and they went to another little town called Foligno. It's in Umbria, and it's very close to Assisi. And again, the Dominicans and the Franciscans come together. So this was St. Francis's land. This was St. Clare's land. They were influenced by all the mysticism, the holiness of that era. And he was also exposed to and influenced by one of the great artists, Giotto. You know, if you've gone to the Basilica in Assisi and you see all those gorgeous Giotto frescoes reproducing the life of Jesus, well, think if you were Fra Angelico and you saw Giotto's work. And Giotto's work was not, it was of its period, you know, the period before Fra Angelico and two periods before Michelangelo. So what does an artist do? An artist learns when he watches another artist. And Fra Angelico picked up. And Giotto was an extraordinary painter. There's a story that I read as a child, and I've never forgotten it. It's just a big old child storybook. He was a shepherd in the fields, and there was going to be a contest. He was very poor. But if you won this contest, you got a certain amount of money, and I think he wanted to use it for his family. So he goes to Florence. It was probably the de' Medicis who were running the contest. I don't know. They were always looking for new artists. And all these artists got up and they showed their paintings. And they were impressive. And then Giotto, this young little shepherd boy, just came and they said, show us your stuff. And he went to the canvas and he drew a perfect circle. And he won. Nobody else could draw a perfect circle. And that was the beginning for him. So what was remarkable about Giotto's paintings was the devotional quality. I mean, you can't go into the basilica and come out the same person if you stand in front of them. And especially there's that one of St. Francis and the birds. Maybe you know it. But, you know, all things come to an end, and the plague hit Foligno, and the monks had to flee. So they went back to Cortona, and for 3 or 4 years, they were back in the place where Francis and Dominic had come together again. And he might also at this time, there's speculation, have gone to Siena. So he's getting exposure to the great mystics of the age, and also to the great artists of the age. And because he was who he was, he's just takes it in and then intuitively expresses it out in his own inimitable way. So eventually they go back to Fiesole, to their monastery at San Domenico. That was home for them. That wasn't until 1418. And feelings were so bad. I love this. Because they had left, it was considered abandoning their place. And so the bishop made them buy it back. I mean, yeah, the bishops in those days, I tell you. But God is good. Just at that particular moment, Brother Antonino, who was, I don't think I've mentioned him before, but he was the prior of San Domenico in Fiesole. He was the one who shepherded Fra Angelico from the very beginning Very holy man. Eventually, he was canonized. Anyway, he gets an inheritance. I'm reminded of Swami getting an inheritance. And what does he do? He builds Crystal Hermitage at Ananda Village. So they were able to go home, and they added on to it big rooms and everything that a convent needs, everything that a monastery needs. And his brother Benedetto kept working at illustration and illumination. But guess what? Fra Angelico started to paint the walls of the monastery and of the church. So his stay there lasted 18 years. You can paint a lot in 18 years. And during that time, that monastery became known for the men who lived there as being very saintly and very benevolent. And eventually, Fra Angelico, his fame began to go out. So he was asked to come to Florence, to Santa Maria Novella. Some of you have been there, and to paint. He was asked to go back to Cortona and paint. And this is when I think the beautiful Annunciation must have been done, because it's a very mature work. He went to Perugia. So he's seeding all of Italy with his vibration, with his devotion. Now, Cosimo de' Medici enters the stage. Now, you know the de' Medicis. They were the ruling family of Florence. They were the great patrons of the Renaissance. And there were generations of them. Cosimo was the one who was alive when Fra Angelico was walking the streets of Fiesole. And he had a very sincere regard for the monks at Fiesole. I think I would like to read a biography of him, because I haven't thought to myself that the de' Medicis were that spiritual. I mean, I knew they were patrons of the arts. But at any rate, Cosimo was spiritual, and he knew a good thing when he saw it. So he ordered panels of pictures from Fra Angelico. And of course, he would pay, and the money would go to the friars. Fra Angelico never got anything. And then they would put it out to be of service to people. So it was a lovely thing. Finally, we get to his themes. His themes are of the divine and of the mystical. And we've already said that, but I want to show you a few more pictures. So here we go. So this is another Annunciation, but this is just completely different. I hope this is the right slide. Let's see. Nope. Wrong dots. My systems are failing me. All right. I'm going to go. Oh, I know where I went. So finally he goes to San Marco. This is what happened. Cosimo de' Medici gives them an offer they can't refuse. He says, come down to Florence, where there's this monastery, San Marco. And he says, the Benedictines have it. The Benedictines were another order. He says, but they're not very good. And he was right. They were just completely corrupt. And he said, we'll throw them out, and I'll give you their monastery. So they did. They came down, and one might ask, well, why would they do that? Well, first of all, the purity of the church would have been the first consideration. But secondly, there was a sense of mission. So you have this group of very powerful, spiritually powerful monks living up in the hills, one of whom is Fra Angelico. Why would you not bring them down to the center? It's just like Swami sending us from the village to Palo Alto. You know, always there was that sense of mission. We can't keep it for ourselves. We have to share it. And we have to go to the very center of the greatest amount of energy to do that. So that's what they did. So they go to San Marco. And it's in disrepair. So they start to repair it. But guess what? They have a fire. And the fire takes out the whole thing. And again, I think of Ananda. You know, we had the fire. We had 19 houses and they were all gone in an instant. Done. But they didn't give up, and we didn't either. So they had a great patron. Cosimo says, well, I have my own personal architect. And his name was Michelozzo. And so he says, I'm going to get Michelozzo to build you a new monastery. And the monks say, okay, but it has to be really spare. You know, it cannot be luxurious. We want something simple. We want something that represents our life, our devotion to poverty and simplicity. And so he said, okay, I will build you something that's simple and austere. But he didn't say that he wouldn't build them something that was big. And so he built them this gorgeous, big church and monastery that we know as today, that is San Marco. It's monumental, but it's also monastic. And from the very beginning that the walls went up, just as in the church at Fiesole, Fra Angelico was commissioned to begin painting. And he painted all of them. He painted the reception rooms. He painted the church. He painted the refectory. He painted the dormitory. And in addition to that, there were 40 cells. That's what they called the rooms where the monks slept. And we saw one, Padre Pio's cell, if you remember that, in Via Rotondo. Anyway, really, you know, small rooms, very unassuming, not pretentious at all. So what does he do? He goes into each one of those rooms and he paints a picture for that monk. So every monk had their own personal masterpiece by Fra Angelico, and this is one of them. And I remember myself, the very first time I went to San Marco, I, in the back of my mind, knew that Fra Angelico had painted there, but I was not prepared for this. And so I walked down. There's a cloister, you know, an inner courtyard, and with a walkway around it. And then you have, it's in the form of a square. And so he gets the idea of the cloister in here. But I'm walking in there, and then it says cells. There's a little sign. And I go up the stairway. And there on the wall, outside of these 40 cells, is one of his masterpieces, the Annunciation. And I think this was the one it was. He did so many, but I think this was the one. And then here's another one. And that was inside one of the cells. Now, have you noticed the difference between these two and that Annunciation's from Cortona? That one had all the gold and the colors, but these don't. And I'm going to ask you while I go through a few more to conceptualize why that might be. This is the presentation in the temple where Mary, all of the young Jewish girls would do this. They would take their child, it's like baptism. They would take their child and they would present it to the priest who is a stand-in for God. And they would say, my child is yours. And that was a spiritual offering. And there's such a purity to this particular one. I don't really know who the figures are on the bottom left and bottom right. We can guess. But. And then here is the Transfiguration. That was in another cell. Imagine going to bed with that. You know, and waking up in the morning. First thing you saw was Jesus transfigured, and Peter, James, and John, in absolute wonder, awestruck, forced to their knees and to protect their eyes because the light was so blinding. And then, of course, there's Dominic on the right. You see him? And that might be Catherine of Siena on the left, but I'm not going to guarantee that at all. But Jesus is there, and then you think of the words, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. Follow him. You know, if I woke up to that every morning, I should get this to put on the wall of my bedroom. And then we have the mocking of Christ. Not too long after the Transfiguration, Jesus was arrested, and he was taken before Pontius Pilate. And Pontius Pilate washed his hands of him. He had the good grace to know he was in over his head. But he didn't really bow out enough. And ultimately, Jesus was arrested. And he was blindfolded, a crown of thorns put on his head. And they mocked him. They spit him. And you can see that Fra Angelico saw that. And what's happening also in that picture is the one I have in miniature of Saint Dominic reading, meditating, and the other, I don't know who she is. But in his mind, in the moment of the greatest possible disgrace and distress, he inserts a contemplative element. And what's the message for us? You know, whatever our trials, we've got to go back inside. We've got to get to that place where Saint Dominic is. We're completely at rest. And then here's Christ on the cross. And again, horrific moment, but the emotions aren't horrific. Fra Angelico had the grace to understand that this was a time for complete and utter worship and abandonment to anything that one might have wanted for oneself. Just utterly giving yourself to the moment. And there you have Saint Dominic. And then we have the Noli Me Tangere, which is do not touch me. And that's Mary Magdalene. Jesus has just risen. Mary has gone to the grave, to the sepulchre, and she doesn't see him. But she sees a gardener. And she doesn't recognize the gardener. But the gardener is Jesus. And therein lies a mystery too. You know, why didn't she recognize him? What's going on there? And yet then she does. He says, Mary, don't you know me? He had a sense of humor. And she says, Lord, now can you imagine the moment of recognition for her, if you were to put yourself into her mind? But he says, Noli me tangere, do not touch me. Because he wasn't ready. He was in transition. And what Fra Angelico did with this painting is quite remarkable. Because if you look at the light, there's Mary, and she's completely ablaze in light. But where is the sun? It's not there. I'm not sure it's over the other direction either. Jesus isn't in as much light. And then in the background, you have kind of this formal garden. It's not out in the rough. So what he has done is he has domesticated these images. They would have been so palatable for the pre-Renaissance mind. So classical. They would have been aware. They would have felt comfortable. And yet, this really strong message of, I'm here, I am with you, and it's good that you're recognizing me, is right there, written all over it. And then finally, this is the coronation of the Virgin. I would like to wake up to this scene too in my little cell, because this is victory. She did not have an easy life. If you imagine what it was for a mother to go through and watch her son do what he did. And it all started when he was 12. She had a lot of years. You know, when he was in Jerusalem and he got caught up talking to the elders in the Jewish synagogue, and they were amazed at his knowledge. And she and Joseph had lost him, and they were worried, and they searched for him for a couple of days or maybe three. And when they found him, he was totally unsympathetic. He says, I am about my father's business. Now, if I were a mother, a typical mother, I would have said, you get in the car. But what did she do? She didn't do that. She took it within, the Bible tells us, and she pondered it. So as a mother of an avatar, she had a particular trial in life. There was nothing that was going to bind him. And so she has that moment, and when the angel came and she said yes to everything. Not once did she say no, except for the marriage feast of Cana. And I think she was entitled, because she was helping people. They were grateful. So here we are. And again, you can see the Dominicans and the Franciscans all together, which actually, it gives me such great pleasure. I've always liked the Franciscans. I like St. Francis. And I've been so a part of, I have an aunt who was a Dominican, so I mean, that whole thing has been part of my life forever. And to have them come together, it's beautiful. But then there's Jesus, and he's giving her the crown. And again, do you see how the aspect that he's captured is the same aspect of the Virgin as in the original Annunciation? Same. So humble, so beautiful. So all of these are in San Marco. There are 40 cells. I think they all have a picture, a fresco on the wall. I'm not positive. And I'm actually not positive that he did them all. By this time, he was getting fairly old, and he had helpers. There's a discussion about whether in the later part of his life, some of his works were completely done by him. And do you know Fra Filippo Lippi of Browning's fame? Well, anyway, he was an artist, and I love his work too, but it's not the same as Fra Angelico's. And apparently he came in and he helped finish some of the canvases. But when you look at the canvas, you can kind of see a dividing line. It's interesting. So now San Marco, it's an art gallery, and you can go there. And if you do go there, I say spend a lot of time. Block out the whole morning, the whole afternoon, whatever you can, and bring your Imitations of Christ, or bring one of Swami's books. Anything that will be a doorway into his consciousness in addition to the beautiful artwork. Now, what is most lovely about these is that he painted them solely for the love, his love of his brothers. Nobody saw these. Not until he died, and not until they made San Marco an art gallery. I don't know when that happened. But there was no money involved. It was simply that labor of love. It was a reminder of devotion, of service to God, of total immersion in one's spirituality. And I have to believe that he knew, because he was such a mystic, I have to believe that he knew the power of his work to elevate consciousness so that it would help his brothers move into that state of mystical consciousness and awareness and love and joy and bliss. Now, there was one cell that was larger than the others, and that cell was reserved for Cosimo de' Medici. Because Cosimo would come, now he didn't have to go to Fiesole for seclusion, he would come to San Marco. And this is the picture that he had on the wall, and it's completely different. It's the Adoration of the Magi. I thought it was so appropriate, because Cosimo was a great man of the world, right? And the great men of the world, well, they didn't know that they were Babaji. Lahiri and Uteshwar, but the great men of the world, the kings from the east, have come, and they bow and they bend their knee, and then there's Saint Joseph over there talking to the first one. It's very conversational. Mary, you can see the baby's leaning a bit toward him, and the mother has this beneficent smile on her face. And that was for Cosimo, a reminder of the true purpose of life. Well, fame does not go unnoticed, and because he became so famous through his art, the Pope called him to Rome. And I can tell you, I think he probably went very reluctantly. It would not be his nature. But this was Pope Eugenius IV, and he used to come to Florence, and he used to stay there too, and he would be given this room to remind him of his humble origins. So the Pope asked him to accept the role of Archbishop of Florence. And yeah, but he said no. He said, no. He said, you know, I'm really not cut out for that, but you should give it to Brother Antonino. And he did. Brother Antonino was the prior. And Brother Antonino was a great guy, and he was born to do that. And he became a saint and was canonized. And then, ultimately, Fra Angelico returned to to San Domenico to become the prior. And I have to think that in his mature years, he just had to say to himself, okay, they're asking me. I turned the archbishop down. I will be the prior. And it's my brothers, and it's Fiesole, and maybe it's a way for me to get out of Florence. You know, it's kind of like us going up to the village or into seclusion. So, what do I need to say more? Vasari, we'll go back to him because he's the reporter of the age. This is what he has to say. He said that Fra Angelico was accustomed to say that the practice of art should be born of repose and peace, and that a painter should take no thought of the world. I like that. And Angelico's words to me and to Sheldon Cheney, I think he actually must have been quite a mystic himself. His works reflect a yearning for God, a renunciation of the world, self-dedication, a disciplined seeking of repose and serenity, a sense of God's immanence, and the consciousness of knowing God's will. All of that. So what we could say, in summation, is that Angelico paints himself. These are all self-portraits. So I'm going to finish. To go back to the coronation of the Virgin, I wanted you to see the detail. I wanted you to see the up close, because it's so beautiful. And when I look at that, I am astonished. I am not an artist, but I am astonished that any artist could render those forms and that feeling using such pale colors. Think about it. It's like champagne and white and ivory. And I mean, a true artist would set me straight, I'm sure. But I mean, isn't that amazing? It's just amazing. And that, my friends, is the end. Do you have one more song, one more chant in you? You do? All right. I thought that we would end with one of Swami's almost last musical composition. Sit up straight. Just close our eyes. Take in the glory of the consciousness of Fra Angelico. Just for a moment. feeling bathed in the aura of gold and peace and love and light. Om peace. Amen. Thank you.